Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service for public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on privacy when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. Now, a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. Every one of these systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Well, knowing how this information is gathered, and what information is stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private, actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of privacy. I'm one of the few guys in the country that's not complaining about the government's intrusion into my privacy. Government isn't intruding into George Gordon's privacy. And I'm sure they have telephone taps on my telephone, and they probably watch my mail and open my mail just like they do yours and anybody else they want to. But there's a certain amount of privacy that we expect and a certain amount of privacy that you don't have any right to expect. And the Supreme Court, in a number of cases concerning the Fourth Amendment, and keep in mind that the Fourth Amendment is ruled on, it's decided upon, more decisions are decided upon the Fourth Amendment than any other section of the Constitution. In fact, so often, there's a publication called the Search and Seizure Law Report that comes out every month, used to anyway, detailing the decisions that the Supreme Court makes on the Fourth Amendment, which is always made on a case-by-case basis. Reviewing those kinds of cases on search and seizure, you know, like Weeks and Carroll, Boyd, Silverthorne, Almeida Sanchez, Delaware versus Prowse, Smerber versus California, etc., these landmark cases, these are the cases that tell us what's private and what isn't. So, for instance, when I pick up the telephone and I want to talk to somebody, I don't say anything on the telephone that I wouldn't say to the FBI chief, or to the CIA chief, or to some policeman, the sheriff, or the chief of police. And that's because there's nothing private on telephone. if I had money in the bank, I don't, but if I had money in the bank, I wouldn't expect any privacy. I would expect my banker to share with the IRS, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, or any other government agency, or for that matter, any insurance company, association, cartel, any business, I would expect them to share all of that financial information with anybody that knocks on their door and says, let me look at it. And that's because there's no privacy in banking. None. Zero. Zilch. And if you think there is, well, then you must have come from La La Land or from Lilliputia. But there are some places that we have an expectation of privacy, and when those expectations of privacy are violated, then there can be some litigation. I'm a little more cautious than that. I like to keep things so private that nobody knows about it. My daddy explained it to me one time. I was about, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years old. And he said, son, let me explain something to you. He said, when you know something and nobody else in the whole wide world knows what you know, that's a secret. And the minute that one other person knows that information, it's no longer a secret. I've got a lot of secrets. I'm the only guy in the world that knows it. It's almost like the perfect crime. You know, if the police don't know that somebody is even dead, it's pretty hard to conduct an investigation into a murder. Now, is it? Jimmy Hoffa's kind of a case in point. We don't even know if the guy's dead, much less if he's murdered. That's what we call a perfect crime. Now, they like to tell us, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect crime. Oh, no, no, no. No, the elitists that are in charge of your government commit perfect crimes every day. These are crimes where events that, if they were known about, would be crimes and would be prosecuted, these events aren't even known about. I mean, you think Halliburton is run by a den of thieves. Well, all you know about is what's reported in the press. You don't know anything about all the thefts that go on that aren't even reported. And it's not just Halliburton. I mean, heck, it's your government representative. Now, once in a while, one of them gets caught. And I ought to tell you quite a little story. Not too long ago, there was a representative from California. He was taking bribes, and I think his name was Randy Cunningham, as I recall. And he got caught. And he confessed, and then he pled guilty, and then he went to prison. And that's the one that got caught. There's 435 of those representatives in the House of Representatives, you know. Another 100 of them reside in the Senate, and that's just in the Congress. I mean, you got state legislators out there, and they're all on the take. Well, maybe not every one of them. You know, you couldn't say they're all. But, you know, when 90% of them are on the take, you can say, well, they're all on the take. And they take from these big corporations, you know, like pharmaceutical corporations or from defense contractors and so on. So when you catch one of them, hey, boys and girls, did you think this is isolated? It's like the story of the Catholic clergy up in Boston where the Catholic Church came out and said, well, okay, it's true. We admit that there are 35% of the clergy, that is the priests and bishops and cardinals and of the hierarchy there, 35% are either sodomites or they're child molesters. Well, boys and girls, do you believe that the rest of the Catholic Church is 100% pure and all the pedophiles and sodomites are in Boston? There aren't any in San Francisco, Los Angeles, or Paris? Hey, come on, kids. It's time to wake up and smell the coffee. If 35% of your clergy, and this is what they admit to, are perverts in Boston, well, you can just about bet that 35% of the Catholic clergy are perverts. And you could carry that a step further. Do you think that that's something that only goes on in the Catholic Church? That doesn't happen in the Methodists and the Presbyterians and Baptists. That's just Catholic. They're perverts, but the Protestants aren't? Come on, kids. You know, being naive, you know, is maybe chic and up to date, and maybe it's even true. You know, it was time that we woke up and smelled the coffee and took a look at the cold, hard world and said, hey, wait a minute. wait a minute, do I want to participate in that? Privacy works the same way. I mean, you can be private. You don't have to tell people what you're doing. You don't have to do things that are out here for everybody to see. I often wonder, you know, about people. They complain about guns and gun registration. I get letters in here constantly, you know. Guns and gun registration. They tell me about how bad they are in California. They went into a Walmart store and they bought a gun. And they had to sign all these forms and all this stuff and one thing and another. And haven't you people ever heard of private sales? Private sales. You know, let's just think about it. Let's suppose that you were looking in the thrifty nickel and some guy had a gun for sale. And you go over to Joe Finkelstein's place and he's got this .30-06 and you say, well, where'd this come from? And he says, well, I got this from my great uncle Buster and I've had it for quite a few years and I want to sell it. And you ask him, well, is it registered? Have you registered it with the state? No, no, it's not registered. How old is it? Oh, it's 40 years old. Be better if it was 140, but then, you know, it's 40. And you buy it and you pay the guy $300-$400 and you walk out the door. Well, there's an unregistered gun. What do you want to do? Go down and register it now and tell the government that you own a gun? So instead of buying the gun from Walmart, why don't you buy it from a private dealer? I don't know what these people are thinking about. They all complain, you know, and I get letters all the time about people complaining about privacy and privacy issues. But there's precious little thought that goes into, well, gee, how would I handle this transaction so that it was private and nobody knew about it? They complain about banks all the time and the IRS and others. Has it ever occurred to you to close your bank account? I know it's kind of wild and off the wall for most of you kids educated in public school, but I haven't had a bank account for many years. I got to tell you a little story over here. I was running a company called Atlantis Manufacturing Company up in Boise, Idaho. And as I was operating the company, we had a bank account and all the normal things that people do, you know, with bank accounts. One time, my caseworker, I was institutionalized at one time, and we had a caseworker, and her name was Mary Trudeau. Wonderful lady. Worked for the IRS, I'm sure, for many years, retired with a gold watch and a pension. Anyway, Mary hit my bank account down at the bank at $10,000, and she took it because of back taxes. The thing that kind of riled me a little bit is that we had a payment agreement. And I'm paying so many dollars a month on the payment agreement. The payment agreement is up to date. Now, the IRS takes, you know, $500 a month plus our current taxes, and we're paying away. One day they say, well, we think we'll just take all the rest of it right now. And they did. They went in and they just took it. The thing that really kind of galled me was that the bank, instead of calling me on Thursday, they did this on a Thursday, the bank could have called me and said, gee, Mr. Gordon, let us report to you what happened. The IRS came in today, took all of the money out of your account. Well, we paid our employees on Friday. See? And so on Friday, I thought we had the money in the bank, so I wrote all the payroll checks and passed them all out. And they bounced all over the place the following Monday. Yeah, the checks bounced. And I thought, well, that'll never happen to me again. And it didn't. It didn't. And so today, I live my life without a checking account. And when I go in someplace and buy something, I buy it, and I pay for it, and I walk out the door. And my privacy has just escalated by about 1,000% right there. You people out there, you don't know how much money I've got. You know, I might have $85 or $90 at any given time, and you don't know how much or how little I have. And I don't keep it in the bank where people can make those kinds of reports to the IRS, and they don't know how much money I've got either. You know, it's not much, but you know, the little bit that I've got, I just didn't want anybody else to know about. And so I have increased my privacy by not having a bank account. And the same thing is true with other public institutions, you know, like the utility company and the gas company. The electric company, telephone company, and all these various companies, you know, that keep records on how much gas you consume and how much electricity you consume and so on. So one day I woke up and I said, you know, that's not a very good place to be keeping records either. Banks and utility companies and landlords and mortgage companies and payments that you're making, you know, on your big screen TV. All of those kinds of activities leave paper trails everywhere. Credit cards, you know, every time you buy something on a credit card, somebody writes up a piece of paper and keeps a record of it and sends it off someplace so that Google or somebody else can mark that down and make that kind of information available to everybody. Oh, there's nobody out there keeping track of my MasterCard account or my Visa account or my checking account, savings account, insurance payments, mortgage payments. There's nothing out there. I eliminated that a long time ago. And so can you. You know, if you put your mind to it, so can you. Now, I'm not out here selling privacy. God forbid that I should get in the way of you spilling your guts and telling your government and your banks and the IRS and everybody else everything about your business. In fact, in America, most people don't have any privacy. They don't desire any privacy. They're really not concerned about privacy. It's irrelevant to them. But there might be 10 or 15 of you out there that are kind of concerned about it, and I just wanted to share with you a couple of experiences and tell you about a couple of events that transpired in the past and point out to you that there's no privacy problem. The government doesn't have a big privacy problem, and when they do, they have a great big to-do about it. Did you know that? For instance, do you know where your chief of police lives? You know what his telephone number is? You know what kind of a car he drives? Do you know how much money he's got in the bank or doesn't? Do you know what insurance company insures his life and so on? I'll bet you don't know any of that information, but you can rest assured that your chief of police has all of that information about you. Now, why is it that your police department has the mortgage payments and the license plate number of your car, but you don't know what the mortgage payments or the license plate number of your local sheriff or chief of police is? So government and government agencies, they don't have a problem with privacy. In fact, they're the purveyors of privacy. They own the privacy. You're the guy that's complaining that you don't have any privacy. And you don't know how to get it, how to keep it if you had a little. Well, you know, the same methodologies that are used by the police and government agencies, you know, they work both ways. What's good for the goose is sauce for the gander, wouldn't you think? Let me tell you a little story here. This goes back a few years, but listen to this story. As we arrive at the watershed year 1984, George Orwell's vision of a society devoid of privacy no longer can be viewed as mere science fiction. In the years since Orwell penned his classic novel, 1984, technological advances have made it possible for computerized data banks to communicate with one another, and what they're communicating about is us. The advent of a vast computer network storing the most intimate details of our personal and business lives has altered our notions of privacy in a very fundamental way. To a disturbing degree, the computer has become Big Brother, and those who have detailed dossiers on our lives have become our thought police. And though it has enhanced modern lifestyles in many ways, the revolution in information technology has exacted a terrible, unintended cost on individual liberty. This immeasurable cost is the dark side of the truly positive advances in computer science that have occurred over the last two decades. In a way, we have become victims of our own success. I'm going to pause right there and say, we have a computer here. We're online. You can dial in, you know, to our computer website. And there's a lot of information that we don't try to keep personal or private. We advertise and we put information out and we try to participate in the computer revolution. In fact, there's a Bible prophecy that talks about that in Daniel chapter 12. God informed us, he said, knowledge would be increased. 90% of all the scientists that have ever lived are alive today. Knowledge is being increased geometrically. There's more information out there available to people in the world today than has ever been available before. And George Gordon is not complaining one iota about computer hackers or anybody else getting into our computers, or the government or the IRS or anybody else finding out things that we want to keep personal and private. And we here at the law school have a lot of things that are personal and private, just as personal and private as our sheriff and chief of police, and we don't share that with our sheriff or chief of police. We just keep it to ourselves. We have a lot of secrets. We have a lot of knowledge, and we have a lot of processes and things that we do and things that we have, and we don't share that with other people. It's private. It's protected. It's protected by the Fourth Amendment. It's protected by the Ten Commandments. It's protected by the laws of God, the laws of the United States, and just plain common sense. Just plain common sense. Just work the three together, and I think you'd be amazed at how private and how personal you can be. Well, Walter Cronkite sums up this dilemma in his foreword to David Burnham's excellent account of the rise of the computer state, published by Random House in 1983, where he said, now this is Walter Cronkite, he said, without the malign intent of any government system or would-be dictator, writes television's venerable journalist, our privacy is being invaded. And more of the experiences which should be solely our own are finding their way into electronic files that the curious can scrutinize at the punch of a button. Oh, my God, I've got to stop right there. I can't contain myself. Remember in the last program I told you about the little girl over in the West Plains Clinic? My wife, you know, was in there getting her ankle fixed. You know, she had a broken ankle. And the little girl came over, and she had the clipboard, and it said, well, what's your social security number, and where do you live? And I filled it out, and I put forth amendment objection. When I walked out of that clinic, those people knew that a fellow by the name of George Gordon and Jacqueline Gordon had come into the clinic. Mrs. Gordon had a broken ankle. They fixed it. I paid them $235 in cash, and I walked out. And when I walked out, they didn't know what my Social Security number was. Now, you know, your Social Security number is kind of innocuous. Everybody knows what it is. And I'm sure a lot of people wish that a lot of other people didn't know what it was. But, you know, it's kind of a public number. And bank accounts, and where do you bank, and do you bank, and do you have health insurance, and do you have hemorrhoids and all this. You know, when we walked out of there, nobody knew whether or not my wife had hemorrhoids or not. We didn't answer those questions. They weren't relevant. Whether or not my wife uses Preparation H on her hemorrhoids or not isn't germane to fixing a broken ankle, but it is common and routine practice for doctors and nurses to ask you those kinds of questions. And it's common and routine. I mean, it's just as common as pig tracks for people to answer those questions. You walk into a dentist or a doctor, he puts a piece of paper in front of you, asks you a bunch of personal information, you answer all the questions and hand it back. And then wonder why it is you don't have any privacy. Hell, you don't even know what privacy is. People that fill out forms like that and hand it over to other people obviously aren't concerned about privacy. I mentioned that a little earlier. The average Joe Sixpack couldn't care less. I'm not here trying to establish privacy for institutionalized people who don't care about it. I'm just concerned about a few people out there that might be interested in privacy, and I wanted to share with you that there's just as much privacy out there in the computer age as there's always been. I mean, if you want it. Now, it is true you have to work harder. You see, 25, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, there weren't as many people that were prying into this or keeping track of this kind of information or writing it down. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, people weren't as nosy as they are today. The nosiest people that I know of are in government. I mean, government employees, bureaucrats that work for agencies of government, I mean, their nose has always been out of shape. They make careers out of amassing information on other people. Most of it's useless. You know, like what kind of a car do you drive and how many miles to the gallon do you get and how many bathrooms do you have in your house? That's basically useless information. But they use that information to raise your property taxes. You know, when you fill out the census report and then you report that you've got three bedrooms and three bathrooms and this and that and another thing, that information goes to your county assessor who looks at it and says, oh my God, look at this. The house at 2204 Jones Road, we've got it down for two bathrooms, and they've got three bathrooms, and we got the census report. Let's up their taxes $150 a year. It's good for the census taker. It's good for the county assessor. It's bad for you. Cost you another $150 a year. So giving out that information to the census taker seems to be pretty innocuous when you do it, and then nobody ever puts together the increase in their property tax with their report on their census forms. They didn't figure that out. Most people don't have that much common sense. They've been to public school. Now, unless this trend is reversed, says Cronkite, we may soon find ourselves in a world where the ability to control public access to personal information is, for all practical purposes, a thing of the past. Personal information? Excuse me. Banks used to take the information that they generated on their customers, and they kept it personal and private. And then the government came to the banks and says, well, we want that information too. Now, the banks don't run out and say, okay, look, we made a deal with the IRS, and we're going to give the IRS all of the personal information that you people think that we're protecting for you. In fact, we're going to continue to make you believe that we're protecting all of your records and personal information, while at the same time we make all of this available to the IRS. One day, the IRS calls for an audit, and they call for an audit because they see that you got $100,000 in your bank account. And you're reporting things like, I have an income of $30,000 a year, but they've got $100,000 in your account, and so that triggers an audit, and they audit you and find out that, well, lo and behold, there are some irregularities in your tax paying past, and so therefore they come against you and say, well, you owe us an extra $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, or whatever it happens to be. And so this innocuous bank account, these convenient checks that you write to pay the utilities and send out your bill paying every month, you know, you say, well, everybody knows it and I'm not keeping any secrets. And maybe it's a surprise to you that you haven't paid your taxes up fully. But, you know, surprises occur. And so you get dinged for some money over here. You have some problems that you hadn't anticipated in the past. They were actually caused by you. You were sharing all this information. Down here on the lower left-hand corner of your check says memo. People put their little memos in there. What was this check for? They write a check and they put it in there. This check was for rent. This check was for hardware. This check was for utilities or whatever it is. And it seems to be innocuous until at some later date, the state tax commission, the unemployment people, the Department of Employment or somebody, they come back and they say, hey, listen, we got to looking at your account over here. You got to looking at my account. How did you get hold of my account? And, of course, they don't tell you how they got it. I mentioned to you last time there's a $1,600 program out there, boys and girls. All I need is your name, Social Security. You know, you're real concerned about Pete from the Mafia stealing your identity, but nobody's concerned about the state tax commission, the IRS, the census department, the banks, the insurance company stealing your ID. They've got all the same information. The difference is they're not running out here and taking your credit card and maxing it out and looting your bank account. They go through the information and say, oh my God, this guy hasn't paid up his insurance premiums. You know, there's a lady, you know, she's got health insurance. And one day she wakes up and her health insurance company cancels her policy because the health insurance company has been doing some research in the computer files and they found out that this lady has diabetes or she's been diagnosed with leukemia or something. And so the insurance company, not being a bunch of dummies, they take the information, say, oh, this lady's a big risk, and we'll just get rid of that risk and cancel her. Or they'll take on somebody else and, no, we won't sell you health insurance. And then these people wonder, gee, I wonder why the insurance company is doing that. It's because you don't guard your privacy. You know, if you go to a doctor and he finds that you've got some disease over here, did you want that spread abroad? Did you want everybody out there in the world to know that you've got leukemia or muscular dystrophy or Lou Gehrig's disease or something else? I mean, you know, it's up to you. I don't care, but just kind of struck me as being, you know, I don't think I'd necessarily want to share that with everybody in the world. Just a thought. And so then people write me letters, and they tell me about the insurance company that canceled their policy, the IRS that pulled the sneak audit, the bank that did this or that to them, or cleaned out their accounts, or you get these deadbeat dads, they call them now. See, this guy changed his occupation. In fact, he moved clear from New Hampshire out to Boise, Idaho, with about 4 or 5 stops in between. And every time this guy's got letters after his name. He's a school teacher, you know. A smart guy. Smart guy. And he didn't pay his child support, see, and so he left New Hampshire and he moved to Virginia, and about, I don't know, 3 months, they found out where he was, and so they hit his paycheck again, and so he moved from there to Iowa, and about 3 or 4 months went by, and they hit his paycheck from there, and he moved to Colorado, and he was there 3 or 4 months, and they hit his paycheck, and he came to my school. I was in Boise, Idaho, operating Barrister's Inn, see, and he came to my school, and he said, they just hit my paycheck here in Boise, Idaho, and I've only been here 3 or 4 months. I just can't figure out how they keep finding out where I'm working and where I'm living. They just follow me everywhere. This guy never heard of Social Security, taxpayer identification number, employee ID number. I guess it never entered his mind. This guy should stay out of crime because crime is not his forte in life. He couldn't be a politician. Politicians have to be pretty alert. Politicians are criminals. Politicians have to be alert criminals, or they get caught like Randy Cunningham and they get put in prison. Successful politicians like Bill Clinton and Hillary and George Bush and, you know, those people, they don't get caught. They're pretty careful in criminals. Yeah, I got to give you a reminder here before we go any further that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, history, health, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about privacy and privacy issues in the electronic age. And Walter Cronkite, in this old-timey article that goes back to 1984, remember George Orwell wrote this book called 1984 with thought police, you know, and doublespeak and all this? Well, it's come to pass. I mean, here you are in the year 2006, and George Orwell's book is past tense. It's already occurred. But that doesn't mean that there isn't privacy. Shucks. Nobody knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or by your own mouth. I mentioned to you last time what I call the Denny's waitress test. Denny's waitress test. When people ask me questions, you know, the people, you know, in casual conversation sometimes get a little personal, you know. You know, they don't come right out and say, how much money do you have in the bank, but they ask questions that lead up to that, because they're kind of curious, and they want to know, well, how much money do you make? Or they want to know, well, how much are your mortgage payments here on your house, or whatever you've got? And so I'm pretty sensitive to that, and so when somebody gets a little bit too personal, you know, they start asking questions, you know, that really is information that's not in my view, apropos to the conversation. I just kind of gently steer the conversation in another direction so that we can talk about something more germane. And then, you know, people's curiosity gets the best of them, so they got to come back to that topic again, and maybe they come back a second or a third time. Now, it seems like to me that if you get a little bit too personal one time, that's an accident. Second time, that's rude. Third time is just plain stupid. So I figure by the time you're getting rude and stupid, it's about time for me to put you in your place. And so sometimes I kind of tell people, you know, that's personal. That's my business, and it's not yours, and I don't want to tell you. Or, why do you ask? How important is that to you? Do you really need to know that? Now, when you get a little bit pushy like that, it usually puts people back in their place, and they back off and, you know, and get back to something more intelligent. Years ago, I figured out that if people want to get rude, and policemen are pretty rude people, you know, then, I mean, these guys, I don't know who gives them their Kellogg's pep or puts their vitamins in their cornflakes in the morning, but they ask some pretty pointed questions sometimes. Now, when you go into a doctor's office, he's not as rude and obnoxious. He asks you all these questions, and he expects you to answer them. And there's just a little something behind that, you know. If you just ask people, if you get real forward, get right up front, about 95% of people are introverts. If you're just a normal Joe Sixpack, you are an introvert. And when somebody puts this piece of paper in front of you and they ask you this information, you don't know how to say no because you don't want to be rude. You don't want to offend people. And the police and salesmen and the extroverts, they know that. They know that, and they capitalize on that. So when Walter Crankcase over here, you know, he uses terms like, unless this trend is reversed, we may soon find ourselves in a world where the ability to control public access to personal information is, for all practical purposes, a thing of the past. And Mr. Cronkite, I agree. You know, for 95% of sheeple out there, they can't say no. They can't tell the doctor, I don't want to tell you that. It's none of your business. Shut up. I ain't talking. I ain't telling. And when they get arrested, they can't shut up. They can't tell the policeman, gee, it seems like to me that I ought to have a Fourth and Fifth Amendment right here to protect, and I don't think I want to talk to you. I got to tell you a quick story about old Fred. I had a student named Fred. He was down in Deming, New Mexico, and he'd been through my civil rights class, and he wanted to score a couple of points on the city of Deming, New Mexico, and they had a law down there in their city ordinance, that required you to identify yourself to a policeman upon demand. 24 states in the Union have those state statutes that require you. It's a law of what we call a law of general applicability. And a policeman comes up, what's your name? You got to tell him. Well, that's what most people think. Now, there's been a couple of decisions that come down, one recently out in Nevada where the court cut out a new piece of real estate for the identification freaks. And then there's the two traditional cases, Brown v. Texas and Lawson versus Colander. Well, this was before the case that came down in Nevada, but it doesn't change anything. The Supreme Court never changed the law concerning identification. 26 states don't require it. 24 states do. Doesn't change Miranda. Doesn't change Brown. Doesn't change Colander. Cuts out a new piece of real estate. Average guy, he doesn't know that. And he doesn't know how to talk to the policeman. Now, the policeman comes up, and he has this new Nevada law. He says, hey, you, identify yourself. Let me see your driver's license. Fairly simple response to that would be, excuse me, here's the Supreme Court now. They said, if this is a criminal investigation, you have to identify yourself. So, I guess the first thing we should ask the policeman, is this a criminal investigation? And if the guy says, yes, this is a criminal investigation. Okay, second question. Am I the target of this investigation? Yes, yes, you are the target of this investigation. Okay, let me invoke Miranda versus Arizona. Let me have counsel present before I answer any questions. Fifth Amendment protection. And the Supreme Court's cut out, you know, three cases on this. The policeman can't convert a claim and exercise of a constitutional right into a crime. Well, old Fred, you know, he's down in Deming, New Mexico. He straps on a .45. He's walking down Main Street, and this cop's driving down the street, and he sees Fred packing heat. It's not against the law to pack heat in Deming, New Mexico. Unusual. I don't doubt that. But it's out in plain sight, and sees packing heat, and the policeman stops, and he says to Fred, hey, you, come over here and identify yourself. Fred looks down, and he says, hey, is this a criminal investigation? The guy says, no. And he says, I don't want to talk to you, and he starts walking away. Well, this policeman, you know, his adrenaline starts flowing. He's not been talked to like that, you know, in his lifetime. So Fred told me, he said he stepped on the gas, peeled rubber, slammed on the brakes, jumped out of the car, ran up on the sidewalk, got up in Fred's face and said, I said I want to know who you are. Fred doesn't have any identification on him. I mean, after all, this is a sting. Why would he be carrying a wallet? And so he says, is this a criminal investigation? The guy says, yes, it is. He says, well, then I want to invoke Miranda. And he shut up. How simple that is. Well, they arrested Fred, and when it was all said and done, Fred settled in an out-of-court settlement with the insurance company, and they took the ordinance off the books. Now, that's a guy that knows what he wants and knows how to get it and knows what the law is and where it's at. And Fred's not complaining about his privacy being interrupted or something like Walter Cronkite here saying that for all practical purposes our access to personal information is going to be a thing of the past. Now, I'm not complaining. Fred's not complaining. There are a few people in the country. I'll just bet you that President Bush isn't complaining. That's about the most public guy in the world. The President of the United States, the guy lives in a fishbowl. You know how much tax he paid last year? You know anything about him? Do you know what his property tax is on his ranch down in Crawford, Texas is? Do you know how many cows he's got? You know how many chickens he has? You know what the number of his Swiss bank account is? You know, there's a lot of information about President Bush that we don't know anything about. You know how much money he's got in Saudi Arabia? Do you know what his business connections are with the Saudi royal family? You know, President Bush lives in a fishbowl, and I'll bet you that he's one of the most personal, private people that God ever put breath into. I never heard him complain about the IRS or the banks or anybody else, you know, getting into his personal, private business. I would imagine if he was real concerned about it, he'd be pushing legislation, don't you? It's kind of like taxes, you know. People that are getting taxed real heavy and have a lot of problems with the IRS, they complain a lot. I remember I used to get taxed heavy, and I used to have a lot of IRS problems, and God, I just complained bitterly about the IRS. Today, They don't tax me at all. I have any complaints about them. They don't mess with me. I don't mess with them. They're all nice guys. But you see, there was a time when I didn't have any privacy in my tax matters. I didn't have any privacy in my business practices. And if you live your life in a fishbowl without any of these protections for your privacy, without any knowledge about how to preserve your privacy, well, that can get kind of hairy. Now, they talk about under surveillance here. You know, the magnitude of the problem can be gauged by the truly staggering amount of information on our lives amassed by the government and business, and to an astonishing degree, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits. Let me pause right there. Boys and girls, if you don't have any bank deposits, and you don't have any medical visits, how in the hell is anybody going to know about them? Boys and girls, if you kept your financial life private, and there's no privacy in a bank, if you kept your medical life private, and there's no privacy in a medical clinic, I mean, you wouldn't be complaining about that. Now, I got to admit, you know, if you've got bank accounts over here and you're running into the doctor's office all the time and getting prescriptions filled and things like that, if you got bad health, I don't have bad health, so I don't need to go to doctors. You know, I stay away from doctors. There's no privacy there, and on top of that, there's no cures there either. Now, it's produced greater efficiency and security, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Yeah, you're going to be scrutinized by insurance companies and banks and the IRS and the State Tax Commission and everybody else if you live in a fishbowl called a bank. Now, I haven't had a bank account since 1978, and how long is that? 88, 98, and 108? You know, in a couple of years, it'll be 2008, and we're pushing 30 years. I can't think of anything I've missed. I don't know of anything. I didn't miss any rides, you know, at Six Flags. I haven't missed any of my travel plans. I don't know of any... particular segment of my life where I've been deprived of anything. I can't think of a single thing in 30 years that I've been deprived of without a bank account. And I have a lot of benefits. Nobody knows anything about my personal, private, financial life. As dull and as uninteresting as that financial life is, and I'm not complaining about the IRS or the EPA or the State Tax Commission or insurance companies or anybody else. I'm not complaining about my county assessor raising my property taxes or tinkering around with me in any way. I'm just happy as a clam at high tide. They don't know anything about me or very little. Or let's put it this way, they don't know anything about me I don't want them to know about. Government officials, insurance companies, banks, and other industries don't know anything about me that I don't tell them about myself. Let me interject a little something here about the census. I got the intermediate census form back in 2000. Now, the lady said to me, she said, "Mr. Gordon, now come in the mail." Do you remember that? They sent it in the mail. You're supposed to fill it out and send it back. They didn't get it back. So they sent the census lady out. She's actually our postmistress at the time. She was the lady that was running the post office. And she said, "Mr. Gordon, you did not send back your census report." Hey, my government knew that I hadn't sent it back. Evidently, they were keeping track of it. They sent me the census questionnaire, and I didn't send it back. And she said she got a report on me. Hey, this guy Gordon, he did not send that back. He didn't answer the questions. And I said, "Well, yeah, that's true. I didn't send it back." And she said, "Oh, Mr. Gordon, you need to. And she encouraged me, preached me a sermon, told me it was the law, and told me how important it all was. See? And so I said, "Well, listen, Did you know that I'm a Hebrew? Did you know that I'm a conscientious objector? Did you know that I'm a religious objector? And then after she told me it was the law, I asked her the question. I said, well, could you tell me what law I'm violating by not filling that out or sending it back? And she assured me that it was the law, and I'm sure she believed it. I'm sure that she believed it. So I said, well, listen, the law is in Title 13. It's in Section 221, 222, 223, and 224. And I said, 224D is an exemption for religious objectors, and I'm one of those. And she says, oh, I did not know that. I said, yeah. So when I explained to her the law, told her where she could go look it up. Now, she told me it was the law, and I had to fill it out. But when I asked her, where is that law, she didn't know. I had to tell her. Now, I'm not the smartest marble in the drawer, you know, or as they say, I'm not the sharpest marble in the drawer, but I'm not brain dead. And so I had taken the time to look that law up to find out, you know, how can I comply with the census law of the United States, take full advantage of the census law of the United States without making anybody mad. Now, I never reported any information concerning the census at all. And I'm sure that she probably said, well, I know Mr. Gordon, so I'm going to report him in our local community as, and I probably got counted. I don't know. I didn't count myself. She might have counted me. That's pretty public. You know, when I'm walking down the street and somebody is standing there on the sidewalk with a piece of paper and a pencil, and they start putting marks down, I mean, they could count me if they want to. That's a public enterprise. It's when that person stops me and says, well, what kind of a car do you drive? How many gallons of gas do you buy in a year? And how much is your rent? You know, that gets to be kind of personal and private. And it's pretty obvious that when people are asking you questions like, what's your social security number? They don't know what it is, because if they knew, they wouldn't ask. They don't know what kind of a car you drive. If they knew, they wouldn't ask. They don't know how many gallons of gasoline or how many miles you commute to work every day, unless you tell them. You know, if you just stop telling all these people all these things about you, if you had applied the Denny's waitress test, you remember what that is? You walk into a Denny's restaurant and you sit down, and the girl comes over and she's got a clipboard, and she says, "What's your name, address, telephone number? Where do you work? Do you have hemorrhoids?" And fill out this form. You'd think that was kind of stupid, wouldn't you? I'll bet you wouldn't answer her questions. I'll bet you if a Denny's waitress came over and asked you for your social security number, you'd get real suspicious real fast and say, why do you want to know that? So the next time you walk into your doctor's office and the sweet young thing comes over and says, what's your social security number and do you have hemorrhoids? Do you use preparation aids? What kind of a car do you drive? How many miles to the gallon does it get? And how many miles do you commute to work? Why don't you say, whoa here, sweet young thing? Why do you need to know what kind of a car I drive, my social security number, my birth date, and whether I'm using preparation aids? Who in the hell told you I had hemorrhoids anyway? They want to know if you're married. Who told you I had a wife? They want to know if you've got children. Who told you I had any children? They want to know if you're employed. Who told you that I was employed? How are you going to pay for today's services? Who told you I'm going to pay? You know, if you stop and think about the questions and the answers, you know about 90% of what people ask you is totally superfluous to the issue at hand. I remember one time I walked in to Thriftway Lumber Company in Boise, Idaho, and I bought a pair of hinges, and I came up to the desk, you know, and I put the hinges down on the desk, and this guy says, he's writing out the receipt, you know, and he says, and what's your name? I said, Johnny Cash. He wrote down Johnny Cash, and he said, and what's your address, Mr. Cash? And I said, 22, and he wrote down 22, and I put down 404, and he put down 404. And I said, 678. And he stopped and he looked up at me and I said, right! So he did. He wrote 678. And then I said, 892. And he wrote 892. And I said, 471. And he said, no, I don't need your social security number. I want your address. And I said, keep writing! I'm giving it to you! By now he's got about 14 numbers written down here. About this point I said, Jones Road. And so he wrote Jones Road. Providence, Rhode Island, And he paused right there and he said, "Well, if you're from Providence, Rhode Island, why are you buying Hinge's hair?" And I said, "Why in the hell do you want to know where I live in Providence, Rhode Island, when I came in to buy these hinges?" You know, boys and girls, what sauce, you know, good for the goose is sauce for the gander, ain't it? I remember old Ralph Yarborough, you know, he was a senator in the Idaho Senate. Senator Yarborough, I was talking to him one day there in the Capitol building, and we were chit-chatting about this thing of privacy, and he said to me, he said, "I've never used the same name twice checking into a motel unless it was by accident." You know, there are people that you run into in the world that are kind of concerned about their privacy, kind of concerned about what's mine is mine, and what I know, and I'm not telling you. I know it's kind of a wild, off-the-wall idea. Now, I know some of you people are sitting out there saying, "What the hell's the matter with this crazy lunatic over here? What difference does it make?" It doesn't. Hell, when somebody asks you, answer. Tell them. If you don't care about your privacy, tell them whatever it is they want to know. When they ask you about your personal, private, married life, sex life, financial business, just go ahead and tell them. I remember one time I was in my school there, Barrister's Inn, and we had a guy come in one time from Boise Cascade, and I started asking him questions. He came in late to class is what it was, and we were talking about the Fourth Amendment, new student. And he came in, and I asked him his name, and he gave it to me, and I said, "Where do you work?" And he told us, Boise Cascade. And I said, "How long have you been there?" And he said, 14 years. I said, "Are you married?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "What's your wife's name?" And while he's doing this, I'm writing this down, so I'm kicking this back. And he said, "Mary." And I said, "How many children do you have?" And he said, "Two." And I said, "Are they boys or girls?" And he said, "I've got two boys." And I said, "How old are your two boys?" And he told me how old they were. And I said, "Well, what school do they go to?" And he told me. I mean, this guy is answering questions that have nothing to do with reality. I'm just interviewing the guy, just getting all kinds of information. And how much do you earn? And he told me it was $14,000 a year. And what's your position? I'm a salesman. And he just answered questions and answered questions. Pretty soon the students in the class, they couldn't contain themselves. And they're starting to laugh. Because I'd already told them. I said, "If you're an American, I can sit here and ask you questions and you'll answer every question that I ask you. And you'll never get suspicious. And you'll never say, 'Wait a minute, this is none of your business.'" He didn't. Until everybody started laughing, of course, and then he became very self-conscious. And then he asked the question, "Do you really need all this information?" And I said, no. I'm just demonstrating a point. If I ask the question, you'll answer it. Whether I need to know, whether I have a right to know, whether I have any business knowing, you'll answer it just because I'm asking it. Because under the circumstances, it just looks like if I don't answer the question, I'll be looking stupid. And I don't want to look stupid. After all, I'm wearing the emperor's new clothes. Always keep that in mind when you're ordering lunch at Denny's. It's called the Denny's waitress test. If you wouldn't answer for a Denny's waitress, there's no reason for you to answer to anyone. All right, we're out of time. We're going to take this up here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. Gotta leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening. And good night, friends.